Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Whale, CEO. This week's episode focuses on the impact of climate change on global food security. From the water-barren fields of Africa to the rice paddies in Bangladesh, droughts and floods have disrupted food production, distribution, and consumption. To the extent that these weather extremes are climate-induced, we can expect more in the years to come. So in this hour, you'll hear from Josette Lewis of the World Food Center at the University of California, Davis. Josette is joined by David Lobel of the Center on Food Security and the Environment at Stanford University and David Wasko of the World Resources Institute. This event was recorded live in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now to our moderator, Max Offheimer. He's professor of international sustainable development at the University of California, Berkeley.
Let me briefly introduce the topic a little bit, and then I've got some questions for the panelists, and then we'll turn to a conversation and questions from the audience. So in 2010, roughly a third of the world's population were engaged in agriculture. The value-added share of global GDP of agriculture was only about 3%. So economists, when they talk about the impacts of climate change, often don't give agriculture as much attention as it deserves, since it's such a small share of global GDP. The sector, however, provides 100% of the calories to 7.3 billion people, of course. What is astonishing and one of the great success stories of the past century, for sure, is that yields of most food crops continue to grow at relatively amazing speeds. This is due to better seeds, more and better irrigation infrastructure, availability of pesticides and fertilizers, and increasingly so management practices on fields, to name just a few factors. But overall, if we look forward, production is certainly under pressure. We have 7.3 billion people now. Professor Lobel teaches a class on what it would take to feed 9 billion people, so we are facing a growing population that is going to demand more sources of protein and more calories as per capita incomes go up. Still, to this day, 795 million people go to bed hungry every night. What climate change is going to do, it's going to add pressure to this already stressed system. So the dimensions of climate change that we worry about often are the increased frequency of floods, too much water. In other areas, drought, so too little water and too much heat. And there's a more recent literature, which I'm sure we'll hear more about today, is the impacts of extreme heat on crops. Now, climate change is a global problem, but it has very local consequences. Getting calories to people is incredibly difficult. Seems like an easy challenge, but it is not. It requires what we economists often assume exists, which is functioning markets. This is one economist that will go on record that markets very often do not function, as we teach in the intermediate economics classroom. They require perfect information or good information and solid technology to get the foods stored and then to the people who want the food or need the food. So what we're going to talk about over the next half hour or so is how climate change is going to affect the system and is going to specifically affect food security, which is a local problem, not a global problem, and hopefully come up with some avenues to help us chart a path, at least in theory, forward. So I'm going to start with a local question, and then we're going to sort of zoom out to the global. So I'm going to turn to Josette Lewis first, and we're going to talk about the California drought, of course. We're facing a massive El Nino, which is coming our way, and for skiing, this might be a good thing, and our reservoirs will be happy. But as California concludes its fourth year of drought, are there any lessons that could benefit other food-producing regions from around the world?
Sure. This is an issue where really the world is looking at California to see what the impacts of the drought are and what we're doing about it. And there's a couple of lessons that I think we've learned that do have global implications. UC Davis just hosted a global conference on this topic last week, and it was very interesting how some of the problems and challenges we're facing are not unique to California. They're global issues, as well as where there's innovation taking place in other parts of the world that we could learn from. sort of the two key take-home messages that California has to offer globally, including in low-income countries, is the importance of investing in infrastructure around water. We have an unprecedented amount of infrastructure created in our state over the last 100 years to both store and move water around from where it's plentiful to where it's needed. We benefit from that in urban areas as well as in agriculture. And those kinds of investments are not being made in very many parts of the developing world, and they will be critical going forward. The other lesson that we learned is the critical importance of groundwater to food production. What has sustained California agriculture during these 4 years of drought has been increased withdrawals of groundwater. And as alarming as that is becoming in our state and has precipitated some important regulatory reforms in terms of now moving toward a regulation around groundwater withdrawals that was passed by our governor last year. If you look at a region like India, they're withdrawing groundwater at twice the rate of California. And the hydrologic systems in South Asia are not that different from California. You're depending on snow in the Himalayas, both for surface water and for groundwater recharge. Places like Bangladesh, you have saltwater intrusion because of groundwater withdrawals. It's very similar in the Santa Cruz region of California and the Salinas Valley, where a lot of our high-value vegetables are produced. So the importance of sustainably managing groundwater, as well as the important value that groundwater has to mitigating the impacts of drought, are two really important lessons from California. And that part of that is a policy agenda, but it's also an agenda of learning new ways to manage and capture water. As you said, one of the predictions of climate change is more unpredictable precipitation in many parts of the world. So you have droughts occurring some years and floods occurring in the other. We may see that, or I think we actually just saw that this weekend, right, in Southern California. We had mudslides and some flooding due to the first effects of the El Nino. So there's some really innovative ways of doing basin-scale catchment of water. So when you do have a lot of water, deliberately allowing flooding of land as a way to recharge groundwater supplies is a new area that California agriculture is investing in as a way to recharge groundwater supplies. And those are fairly low-cost types of investment. There's some infrastructure that needs to be put in place, but it's not the same thing as creating reservoirs, for example. So there's some really good things that we're learning here in California going forward in terms of how to sustainably manage our groundwater resources, both from an environmental sustainability perspective, but also so that those bank accounts of water are available to agriculture under the ground. And that's a lesson that has huge global implications because groundwater is such an important part of irrigated agriculture in a number of regions of the world.
I'm very sympathetic to that point. And when we think about policymakers trying to attack some of these issues, is this something where you're thinking that regulators or governments should be providing these infrastructure systems? Is this something that governments can step in and do? Or is this something that's got to happen at the farm level? So is there something centrally countries can do to help us cope with this challenge?
I think it's both. Just look at the water resources in our state. I'm not going to get these statistics exactly right, but the vast majority of precipitation that occurs in the state of California occurs in the top third of our state, and yet the majority of our population is in the bottom two-thirds. So there's no way around the fact that we have to move water in California, and that is going to take government policy at the state level in order to invest in that for the benefit of the state. There can be private investment in that, but clearly there has to be some government investment because it isn't something that occurs at a small scale. You have to move water in long distances. And that same sort of challenge will face a number of countries around the world. So there's always a role for some level of government investment. Certainly, those can be complemented by small-scale water catchment systems that can occur on farms or in rural areas in developing countries, and there's a lot of work that is being done to develop those kind of small-scale catchment systems that can support small-scale irrigation in developing countries. Water demands are only going to increase, not only because of increased population growth, but because of increased economic growth in the developing world. The demands on water are only going to get higher. And so there's almost no way to escape the need for both investing in capturing and efficient use of water, which is going to be a combination of local and national solutions.
Thank you. On that note, let's turn to David Lobel. How much can we hope to avoid impacts on agriculture by adapting, and maybe point out a little bit of what you consider to be the big potential impacts on agriculture from climate change?
Yeah, thanks, Max. Well, in terms of the big impacts that we worry about in terms of food security, you know, it really runs the whole spectrum from the basic production of food, and there are definitely reasons to think that the conditions that are becoming more and more common are going to be pretty harmful in a lot of parts of the world for production. Then sort of post-production issues of storage and transportation with more extreme events, with higher temperatures. We don't know much about that, but there are reasons, you know, to be concerned. And then certainly at sort of the household level of their ability to afford food, kind of the overall economic and health impacts of climate change are a concern that's related to food security. You know, we understand the production part pretty well. We understand the other parts not that well at all. But, you know, the latest IPCC report, for example, says that there's a pretty high risk to food security in the sense that we're potentially putting hundreds of millions of lives at risk by the specter of large amounts of climate change. So then the question becomes, well, what can we do about it? And I think there's kind of two related questions, but they're a bit different. And one is sort of what should we be investing in terms of food security and agriculture? And there's a lot to do there, and I think I'm quite optimistic in general on what we can do. But the other set of question, which I think is often confused as being the same thing, is how much can we reduce the negative impacts of climate change? And this word adaptation often kind of invokes this kind of idea that, well, we have the option of either trying to reduce the amount of climate change or figuring out how to avoid the negative impacts and just letting the climate change continue. And I think there it's a much harder sell. And if you take the case of California that Josette was talking about, you know, we do expect that drought conditions, particularly the combination of really high temperatures and low rainfall, maybe not as severe as we've seen in the last few years, but those kind of conditions are becoming more and more likely over time. So are there things we can do to cope better with drought? Definitely. And I think Josette pointed out a lot of those things. But we should be doing those things now anyway. They would have benefits now anyway. With climate change, you know, they might help us kind of regain some of the ground we've lost, but it doesn't reduce the fact that climate change has caused negative impacts. If you look in a lot of other agricultural areas of the world, you know, most of them being rain-fed, a big issue is, or a big focus now is, why don't we develop more stress-tolerant crops? And I think that nobody can argue, that's like arguing against, you know, mom and apple pie. We want crops that are stress-tolerant, yes, of course. But what you have to realize is that a lot of recent innovation in agriculture, a lot of the progress that Max referred to at the beginning in this kind of unprecedented historic increase in productivity has been because the crops are more stress tolerant. And because they've been more stress tolerant, we've been able to pack them in more densely. We've been able to get more food per unit land. And that is going to continue to be an important source of growth. So when we look to stress tolerance as a way of improving agriculture, absolutely. Can we look at it as a way of reducing the impacts of climate change? It's not so clear. So I guess I'm optimistic on lots of fronts, but in terms of our ability to have the luxury of not reducing climate change in a sense, I'm less optimistic on that particular question.
So a follow-up to that, a lot of the work on climate impacts on crops has focused on sort of high productivity environments. You know, we know a lot about the U.S. corn-soy system and how it responds to extreme heat events. When I'm worried about climate impacts, I'm not necessarily so worried about those systems. What I'm really worried about are systems in sub-Saharan Africa that are already, you know, highly stressed, significant water scarcity, inability to store crops from harvest season to harvest season. Is the prescription there different? Is there any hope or anything that's other than just saying we need better varieties that we could work on to try and offset or at least ameliorate some of the damages from climate change in those systems?
You know, there's certainly lots of things that are needed. We obviously know more about, I think, the more sophisticated systems in terms of having the data sets. I mean, you work on this stuff as well. You know that As scientists, we tend to go where the data is good, and we use those kind of as a way of building our understanding and testing our understanding. And in many ways, some of that understanding does carry over into other areas. But if you look at the poorest parts of the world, especially sub-Saharan Africa or South Asia, which kind of by definition have the biggest food security threats because they do have the largest number of food insecure now, it's a combination of improved varieties, improved management, and that really comes down to improved ability of farmers to take on risk, to make investments. There's all sorts of institutional challenges there that I think social scientists are beginning to understand what does work in certain environments. A lot of these things would make sense anyway, so this is not necessarily specific to climate change. But there are some, I think, particular aspects that deserve attention because of climate change and wouldn't probably otherwise. For example, when we talk about stress-tolerant crops, this is a very general category of things. If you think about climate change, one of the things that really it puts more emphasis on is looking at crops that can withstand a few days of 40 degrees Celsius, over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. That becomes more and more important in these systems now and going forward, whereas it wasn't in the past. So that's kind of an aspect of stress tolerance that we're more interested in. Some of the water harvesting issues that Josette mentioned, I think, become more potentially more useful as rain becomes more episodic and extreme. But I would say that, for my money, I would guess in sub-Saharan Africa, I think most of our attention is on the things that would be needed without climate change anyway, and that kind of on the margins, you need to think more creatively about what is different and what is new. But there's certainly a long list of things that people have said should be done in Africa, and the question is what's actually going to work.
If I could just add a point to that, and I'm going to become sort of a water person, I guess, which is, given my background is more in the crop breeding side of things, it's kind of ironic, but moving back to California, you can't help but care about this topic. In addition to the extreme temperatures, which for certain crops has dramatic effects, things like wheat, for example, which are not actually very productive over a wide range of temperatures, are very sensitive to heat. So breeding out some of that sensitivity, as you would see, say, in a corn crop, is an important target. One of the absolute predictions in all parts of the world is less predictive, less regular rainfall events, and either less or more or just more unpredictable as to when they're going to come. And that's where our lack of investment in irrigation systems, particularly in Africa, I think is going to be a critical component going forward. Less than 20% of global agriculture is irrigated, yet those irrigated acres produce over half of the food worldwide. So it's an incredibly powerful tool to increase productivity. And when you look in Africa, less than, I think, 6% of land is irrigated. And so that is a key component and one that hasn't gotten, I would say, having spent 16 years at the U.S. government's development assistance program in agriculture, that's an area we have not invested sufficiently, and we've been depending too much on, I think, some of the genetic approaches to improving productivity and stress tolerance. And I think you mentioned the important issue of risk. I mean, one of the things that's really tough when you think about small-scale farmers who comprise about half of the world's poor. I mean, half of the world's 800 million that are living on less than $1.90 a day are farmers. So that's a really big tool for poverty reduction, is to work on agriculture. When you're that poor, you really can't afford to take very much risk. You will choose to go with some varieties of crop that are less productive because they're more predictable over time. So the issue of risk is a really huge challenge that I think we've come to understand a little bit better in trying to work on agricultural development. And there are some tools that people are trying to develop to help with this question around mitigating risk, including things like small-scale schemes for weather-indexed insurance that you can provide to small-scale farmers. A lot of work that's being done to provide more information on weather to small-scale farmers through SMS and text messages on cell phones, which are remarkably well adopted by the poor. Those are important as you get into more unpredictable rainfall because, a key make-or-break factor is when to decide to plant. And if the weather becomes more unpredictable over time, your personal experience as a farmer becomes less relevant to being able to know when to plant. And so things like that become really important tools as well.
Excellent. Thank you. Let's turn to David Wasko. What I'm really interested in, I hope that next spring we'll be able to say we'll always have parrots. As we head into the climate negotiations this fall, what I'm really interested in your opinion, if we look at these national plans and national commitments that people are making and the documents that back these up at a national level for both mitigation and adaptation plans, what do you think the consequences here are for food security? So for those of you who don't know what we're doing in Paris, it's a little bit like a weight loss plan. Every country steps up and says, I am contributing 5 pounds of weight loss to the overall weight loss that we all have to lose jointly. There is no mean person standing over them saying, you know, you have to do this. We're all going to commit to this weight loss and hopefully stick to this over time. So that's the plan in Paris, and these are the plans we're currently submitting. So how do you think this new policy regime that hopefully will emerge out of Paris is going to affect food security?
Well, let me start with the analogy. I think the evidence out there, correct me if someone knows this is wrong, is that weight loss plans work best when you have a buddy or better yet, a group that you're part of, right?
Correct.
And so I think one of the tasks, in fact, of this new agreement is to create a sense that countries are moving together. There are now 150 countries that have put forward their national climate plans leading into the negotiation in Paris. The Paris moment will be both about sort of collecting those and also creating a framework, an agreement. In a sense, it's the Paris is the time that the countries get together as a group and then also commit, hopefully, to coming back together as a group at regular intervals to look at what they've done and to increase the actions that they're taking. So hopefully it's an effective weight loss program, in essence. There are two dimensions to the national climate plans that countries are coming forward with. Part of it has to do with emissions reductions. And what we're seeing in terms of what those add up to so far is that it gets us roughly halfway where we need to go in terms of the emissions reductions needed in order to keep global temperature rise below 2 degrees Celsius or 3.6 Fahrenheit, which has been globally agreed as sort of a critical threshold for dangerous climate change. So we've gotten part of the way there, but clearly not all of the way there yet. And one of the things that we really are going to need out of the Paris Agreement is a commitment by countries that they are going to return optimally at five-year periods in order to be able to keep ramping up action. Now, that means that we're still facing a trajectory right now that will lead to significant impacts over time. And I should say it's important to recognize that emission cuts today are ones that we bear the fruit of in the future, and we're already facing the impacts now of things that happened in the past. And so even if we went to zero, just arguably, today, we'd still have a good 30 years of rising emissions, and obviously we're not going anywhere near zero. So the impacts are something we are going to have to address as we also take action to reduce the emissions. So as I said, these national climate plans are in two parts, partly reducing emissions, but also most developing countries have come forward with plans that include adaptation and climate resilience as part of what those countries are doing to address climate change. And I think it's important to bear in mind what David said about some of the limitations potentially of taking adaptation action or building climate resilience because of that increasing pressure that's going to be placed on our food systems. But there are steps, as we just heard, that can be taken. And of those 150 national climate plans, 120 of them, by our count, we've been following them as they've come in, and it's been quite a wave, actually, in the past several weeks. 120 of them addressed agriculture in some fashion. Not all of those deal with questions of agriculture in terms of adaptation or resilience, but many, many of them do, and nearly 60 of them address food security in some fashion. It's often brief how these are dealt with. These are typically 15 to 20 page document. So you don't have extensive information there, but what it does point to is that countries are taking these issues seriously, taking the threats and the risks seriously, and putting it into the ways in which they are going to take action on climate change. Just a couple of examples. In Ethiopia, they talk about their adaptation strategy in the agriculture sector, including addressing crop varieties, and also food storage is something that they intend to focus on. They want to look at links between agriculture and forestry in Ethiopia and elsewhere, how to do agriculture and beneficial forestry in linked ways is quite important. And because of that, they also want to look at how their work on adaptation and resilience can be synergistic with work to reduce emissions. So if you're doing forestry, for example, you can both help your agricultural system and also use those trees as a way to soak up carbon. In Laos, we see a very similar pattern in terms of the issues that they're looking at. They want to address appropriate, resilient technologies in agriculture, look at tolerant crops, and how they can go about developing and implementing those. They also want to focus on flood and drought areas in particular, and look at conservation farming systems and agroforestry, and also, as I mentioned, look at how one can synergize work on adaptation with work on emissions reductions. So these are just two of the examples, but I think good ones of how countries are thinking about tackling these issues in the Paris context.
Having experts on the panel is always nice because we get to hear what they know. But what I'm, as an academic, actually really interested in is to figure out what is it that you wish you knew, or what data or sources of evidence are we lacking going forward? Academics always ask for more research funds because we want to know more, but this is what we do, right? We generate knowledge, and unfortunately it takes very little but some money to do that. So the World Resources Institute has been at the forefront of gathering data from thousands of different sources and putting them in formats that all of us can understand. They're my number one go-to on, you know, if I need to give a presentation, their website is really quite amazing. But in terms of the next, you know, 10 years, as we go forward and try and do another one of these IPCC assessment reports, what are the big open questions and what is needed to answer them? So maybe David Lobel, do you want to take this first?
Yeah, I can take a stab. As I said before, I mean, we still don't really understand the basic magnitude of potential impacts in different aspects of food security. For example, if you look at a lot of food security issues in the poorest parts of the world have to do with compromised health and sort of the inability to absorb nutrients. And so there's all sorts of, you know, vector-borne, waterborne diseases. We don't really understand very well the pathways of climate change impacts on those, as one example. Or we have concerns about the nutritional quality of food and the micronutrient qualities of food and how those are affected by rising CO2 and changing climate. So, you know, there's a whole suite of potential impacts that we still need to understand to know whether or not, you know, we need to worry about those and whether or not we need to devote significant resources. So that's one area. But I think the bigger area is just figuring out more generally what works and when it works, because there's 100 things that we could say. You know, one of us could say we should do, you know, forced recharge of groundwater. Another one will say, you know, we should try to do agroforestry. Another one will say we should do no-till farming and build up carbon in the soils. We should have, you know, joint forestry, agricultural products. Like, everything sounds good, right? But when it comes down to it, you have to decide what are you going to invest in. And, you know, you could give 5 cents to everything, but that's not really going to be effective. So how do you quickly learn what works, and how do you understand not just what's working in a very local context, but what actually is making a difference at scale and globally? As an example, I think my hypothesis is that a lot of projects in agriculture in particular are not thinking of the big impact that deforestation has on global climate change and the big kind of role that agriculture plays in driving deforestation. So a lot of the kind of low carbon technologies that are out there arguably can be counterproductive from a climate standpoint because they're lowering the productivity of the system, which kind of increases the demand to bring more land in. And so you could, you know, counterintuitively be reducing climate change by using more fossil fuels and more energy existing systems right now. I mean, that's not proven, but those are the kind of things we have to understand what works and what works in the global context. So how do you do that, I guess, is maybe more to your question. And this is going to start to become self-serving. I mean, our research program is really focused these days on and just measurement technology. So how do you, with satellites, with all of the different sensors that are out there now, how do you actually very quickly learn, okay, this project has been in this community for 3 years. What's its cost effectiveness? What's the impact? And obviously foundations and governments have been interested in impact all along, but, you know, again, they haven't been able to do in many cases a good job of actually understanding what's working. So there's just a huge list. I mean, maybe it's exciting as an academic, it's frustrating as somebody who would want to just design policy right now. If you get a big agreement in Paris, you know, where should we be investing money? But I would invest a significant fraction of it in just our ability to learn and measure things more quickly.
Anybody else want to answer that question?
I'd certainly agree with David that the challenge is really thinking about scale, because you can do things that look nice on a small scale but aren't going to necessarily move the needle on these big global issues. And for me, I'm not a researcher, actually, though I sit at a university. I guess I think I operate more in the policy realm from so many years in government. You know, I sat through the panel this morning on changing diets. We're not looking enough at the intersection of some really big trends in the world. So changing diets, which currently are going toward consumption of more water-intensive and more resource-intensive diets, generally speaking. Everyone always thinks of that in the context of eating more meat, and certainly that is a part of it. But we want the world to eat more fruits and vegetables because we are going into an epidemic of chronic disease around the world, including in very poor countries. India is in the top 5 in terms of number of people with diabetes and is in the, I think, top 1 in terms of micronutrient malnutrition at the same time. So big health transitions going on in our world associated with diets, rapid urbanization, which is going to both influence the diets and also influence natural resource use, and climate is going to have a huge impact, particularly on one of those natural resources, water. And I don't think we're looking enough at the intersection of those trends and trying to understand those intersections, because we could work really hard on one piece of that, on the food production side of it, and miss the boat on the fact that global consumption patterns are changing and that's going to drive new problems in our agricultural system. So I think for me, it's that intersection point of these big global trends, and I don't think from the little bit that I do understand about the UN climate negotiations, water is not on the agenda, and agriculture is not on the agenda. It may be on the country plans, but it's not on the discussion about how we're going to mitigate and adapt in terms of the government-to-government text agreement kind of aspects of our climate negotiations. So I agree we should be mitigating climate change for a whole host of reasons, but I don't think we're yet really looking at what the full impact will be when you overlay climate with these other big global trends that are taking place.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Josette Lewis of the World Food Center at UC Davis. She's joined by David Lobel of Stanford's Center on Food Security and the Environment, and David Wasko of the World Resources Institute. They are in conversation with UC Berkeley professor Max Offheimer. This episode was recorded live in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now back to our conversation.
David, what do you want to know?
Well, a couple areas that I think deserve more exploration than they've gotten. One has to do with the global nature of the food security challenge in the context of climate change. And typically, adaptation and climate resilience are talked about as a local set of issues. Now, there may be international processes and support and so forth that need to be addressed, but typically it's discussed as something that's a very local matter. And I think in the case of food security, there's a global dimension, in fact, to it in many ways that we're missing, and we're not thinking about the ways in which we may need to build climate resilience at a global scale. In many places, for example, sub-Saharan Africa and much of Asia, a majority of the food is produced by small-scale food producers. On a global scale, we're moving food around quite a bit. Oxfam and others have done work looking at what would happen if there were concurrent food crises, agricultural production crises in different parts of the world. If you had simultaneous crises, food prices would go up quite substantially. So we're not thinking about how we might address that. Do we need food reserve systems, for example, that would work to handle those issues? And I'm just sort of touching the surface of that question because it, I think, comes back in some cases to how do you strengthen the role of local food producers and so forth. But nonetheless, I think we have to begin thinking about this as a global challenge. That brings me back to the question about the negotiations that Josette was raising, because I think the agreement text doesn't really discuss any sectors, either in terms of emissions reductions or in terms of adaptation. What we need, in fact, is part of this group diet plan, is to have real conversations about what countries have put forward in their national climate plans. What are the challenges they're facing? What are the potential solutions? And then as an international community, how do we go about strengthening the best approaches, providing the resources that are needed for the best approaches, and so forth?
Thank you. Let's turn to questions from the audience. You filled out lots of blue cards with way too many good questions, so we're not going to get to all of those. So the nice thing about being the tallest person on the panel is I get to pick the questions here. So I was going to ask this myself. Any expert can feel free to grab this question. Do you believe that GMOs can help plants survive this drought and climate change? So, or maybe a little bit more broadly, you know, what role will GMOs play, or, you know, are they going to help us deal with this food security challenge? So I'm taking volunteers.
Well, I'm happy to weigh in on that. There's no GMO crop that would survive a drought in the sense of long-term water stress. And plants need water to grow. You know, you can try to villainize agriculture for its use of water, but sorry, plants can't grow without water. neither can we, for that matter. When people work on things like drought-tolerant crops, or what they often call drought-tolerant crops, it's to address short-term drought or short-term inadequate water. So when the rain, if you plant, you're a rain-fed maize grower in Africa, and you plant the rainy season is coming on, and maybe the rainy season doesn't come on with the right intensity early on, a drought-tolerant variety, whether it's classically bred or GMO, is helping you bridge that short-term water stress in the plant. But there's no plant that you could, you know, there's no crop plant that we could grow in California and not irrigate all summer and get a good yield that is economically viable for that farmer to produce. That we just go too long without water, and the same is true in all parts of the world. I will say that there are small-scale farmers growing GM crops right now, and that is part of their food security strategy in terms of income generation. So there are millions of small-scale cotton producers in India, China, Burkina Faso that are growing GM cotton. There are millions of small-scale maize producers in South Africa and Philippines who are growing GM maize. And there are African governments and African research institutions that are testing everything from cowpeas to cassava to bananas that have been genetically engineered. So there are countries in the developing world that are investing in these strategies, and there are many farmers growing these things. But they're by no means the solution to climate change or to drought. No one of the technologies we've talked about or one of the investment strategies today alone will be sufficient. There's a whole bunch of different tools, including classic breeding as well.
One recent paper I read, or a bunch of papers actually, that doesn't look at necessarily what seeds are available and what you grow, but actually how to get the ones that we know work to farmers is also another interesting question here. Is you might have a crop that is perceived as being genetically modified, has higher yields, better drought tolerance, but how do you get the consumer to actually consume that crop? So there's a lot of social science research out there now that, you know, goes from the experimental farm to the actual households and consumption, where there's one breakdown there, not just on the GMO side, but on the actual changing habits side to ensure better food security. So this is overall something that I think is also an important area of research, is not just look at the experimental farm, but take it to the to the plate in some sense.
If I could just illustrate an example of that that has nothing to do with GMOs, but just shows you how important that is the introduction of orange flesh sweet potatoes in sub-Saharan Africa. So the sweet potatoes that are often consumed in southern Africa are white, so they're lacking beta-carotene, or which is pro-vitamin A, and vitamin A deficiency is a serious problem in the developing world. Simple solution is to eat orange sweet potatoes. But the cultural change and behavior to encourage families to eat this non-genetically engineered orange sweet potato, the kind we're more familiar with, is not a small undertaking. So it is important.
Mm-hmm. I would just add one anecdote on that. So some time back, I was in South Africa, and I would mentioned David's research to some folks there about the impact that climate change was going to have on corn in southern Africa, which is quite substantial in his research. And I said, well, you know, what are the prospects for diet shifts here from corn to cassava, for example, which does a fair bit better? And, you know, folks said that's going to be a really tough thing to handle.
Just to to interject how culturally fickle we are. Corn is not a native food to Africa. That was introduced through colonial movement of crops around the world. They're used to eating sorghum or millet, but it's very hard to prepare sorghum for consumption. It's very labor intensive. It doesn't taste as good as corn. So there's an example of a relatively modern change in diet that they're not really interested in going back to.
So I've got two interesting questions, and I'll again let volunteers pop up here, but this is very much concerned about the larger scale picture. So if we're thinking about a world with climate change may disrupt some areas where farmers are farming today, but farmed areas may change, right? We might be growing crops where we're currently not growing crops, so imagine the Corn Belt moving north. Is that one sort of endogenous or natural avenue of adaptation? And to follow that one with a second question here is, does that change from a geopolitical point of view who are going to be the key future food importers and exporters? And what might that mean for geopolitics? Two great questions.
I guess the Canadians are going to get very...
Canadians take over the world.
Yeah, they're going to get very aggressive. We definitely... There are scopes for adaptation along those lines, both in the sense of shifting to new areas where we're not growing crops or to really upheaving the current systems that are in place and going to another one. So if you look at, for example, the southern part of the Corn Belt in the U.S. now, what's happening a little bit, and we expect to happen a lot more, is that instead of growing corn, what they'll do is they'll go to a double crop system where it's now warm enough that they can actually get two crops in. They can start early enough in the spring and finish before the first frost of the fall. And those kind of shifts will happen. In my opinion, those kind of shifts will happen more quickly because it doesn't require a wholesale kind of development of a new area and shift of population, et cetera. But certainly there are pockets in Canada and parts of China, Northeast China is already seeing a big increase in rice production, for example. Russia, Siberia, just that if you look at the numbers, the kind of that small benefit gets outweighed by the massive amounts of areas that are going to be negatively impacted, and not to the point where they're going to stop producing, but to the point where, you know, there are significant yield losses. If you look around the world, definitely we grow food where it tends to grow well, but there's a lot of other factors involved. And if you have already a big infrastructure in place, you know, for example, the Corn Belt of the United States has huge infrastructure associated with it. You know, the fact that its yields decline a little bit and the yields, relative yields in say, southern Canada go up, that'll shift things on the margins, but it's not going to wholesale kind of shift everything into Canada, especially because you got things like the beautiful deep soils of the Corn Belt that is still going to make it attractive.
Anybody else want to follow up on that? I've got a number of great questions still. All right, let's go with the next question here. So this is something I thought more people were going to ask because I like this one a lot. Let's talk about energy, right? It's the topic du jour, maybe the topic de millennium, if that's the French for millennium. But so agriculture, the sector itself, is a major consumer of energy. You know, the production of what goes into the production of crops. You've got to power your tractor, pumps. The shipping of goods is a key input cost. So traditional sources of energy, by that I assume the person is meaning fossil fuel combustion, are considered not helpful from a CO2 perspective. I think we can agree on that. What will the energy source for agriculture be that continues to ensure affordable food? So I'm going to add one on there, right? So even in a brave new world where everything's powered by the sun and wind and whatever other renewable thing we've got going, affordable food, right? So we always think that low food prices are a really great thing. Is this necessarily true, or is this something that's not universally true? So I'll point my finger at David at the other end of the table here.
Well, I think in general that agriculture is one of the trickiest areas in terms of how we handle emissions as a whole. And that's true not only in terms of fossil fuels and CO2, but also if you look at methane, for example. If you look at how nitrogen fertilizer ends up resulting in related emissions. So it's going to be, I think, in fact, you know, compared to, let's say, our electricity system is going to be one of the areas where we have the greatest challenges over time. And thinking through, there's been discussion about the notion, as the G7 put it, of decarbonization over the course of the century. And I think as we find ourselves deeper and deeper into the century, we're going to find agriculture being one of those areas where we have the most challenges. So in terms of modern harvesting techniques, for example, and plowing and so forth, I think we'll have to look at and you can just start with plowing, for example. I think the question of no-till agriculture, and my colleagues probably know more on this question, but no-till agriculture as an option that could work in terms of, first of all, reducing the need for energy inputs to actually do the planting, but then also the ways in which it can be part of a sustainable agricultural system. So that's one example of the directions that we might be able to go.
Yeah, I'll just offer a couple other perspectives. I mean, definitely the trend in energy consumption in our food system is actually going up, not down. I think I've read a report by USDA that said energy consumption in the food sector is increased at 6 times the rate of energy growth in other industrial sectors. A fair portion of that is around processing. And I think you just go in your grocery store and you look at how you buy produce now compared to 20 years ago. There's a lot more energy put into that semi-processed and packaged whole vegetables, for example. You know, when you buy baby carrots or a washed bag of spinach, any of that kind of fresh pack innovations, which have a positive side in encouraging consumption of healthy foods. The invention of baby carrots, when that was introduced in the market, carrot consumption went up 33% in the United States. So that's a good win for nutrition, but probably not a win for energy. I think this is an area where California is going to be a great laboratory to look at how we can reduce the overall carbon footprint of our food system. We have a cap and trade regulation that will put caps on the food processing industries in our state. So that'll notably affect wine and processing tomatoes in particular, but also the vegetable and fresh pack industry will be subject to the kind of emissions caps that any industry is subject to. And we're testing out whether you can provide incentives for reducing greenhouse gas emissions through the provision of carbon credits to agriculture. I think the state approved the first crop methodology to apply for carbon credits through emission reductions. So that remains to be seen if that's an important incentive for growers. But I think probably the biggest way in California that we will make progress towards emission reductions is actually through water quality legislation. So nitrate contamination in groundwater is an emerging issue in our state, and there is increased pressure on agriculture to manage nutrients, fertilizer leaching into the groundwater. And what that will do is probably incentivize new fertilizer management protocols on the farm, and fertilizer use is actually one of the most substantial sources of greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture, in addition to rice production and livestock production. But fertilizer produces nitrous oxide, the most potent greenhouse gas, and that's an issue for the emissions sector from agriculture. So in reducing nitrates in groundwater is going to incentivize changes in fertilizer management practices, which will probably result in reduced emissions as well. So we're going to see some interesting policy tools, I think, in this state that may incentivize reduced energy consumption and reduced emissions from our food system more.
So I just wanted to...
I think the other David had a follow-up quickly.
Yeah, just two additional items, I think. One is around energy for irrigation, and mm-hmm. Josette mentioned the importance of irrigation. One of the questions going forward is going to be, in fact, how to power that irrigation. And so that is an opportunity, I think, to shift from fossil fuel use as an energy source to renewable energy sources. And in fact, in off-grid areas, renewables are going to be the thing that you probably are going to be best able to use cost-effectively as an energy source for irrigation. Second thing I would just point to is food loss and waste. And the sustainable development goals that the UN just adopted 3 or so weeks ago include a target around cutting food loss and waste globally in half by 2030. The loss part, I know, clearly refers principally to developing countries, not entirely, but largely to developing countries, the waste part to more so to developed countries. But in any event, addressing this food loss and waste challenge is an opportunity to find ways to reduce the need for unnecessary production and thereby reduce the energy inputs that go toward food production.
Thank you. David LaBelle.
Yeah, just quickly, I mean, I think this is a good example of an area where I just think that the issue's been a bit overblown, in that if you were to reduce all of the fossil fuel use in the production of food globally, if you were somehow to manage to transition that all to low carbon, no carbon energy, which I think, you know, is happening eventually, it amounts to about 2% of global energy use, and it amounts to a very, very small fraction on the CO2 emission side. So it's become just naturally more efficient over time. So like energy use on the production side, at least, has gone down even as our production's gone up. So I think the bigger issue in terms of agriculture is with the non-CO2 gases, as David mentioned. And then I do agree with him that, you know, that the opportunity for renewables is not just to displace the current use of fossil fuels, but it's to open up new opportunities in remote areas, and that could be a really positive thing for development in general.
Nobody bit on my price question. I'm disappointed, so I'll bite. I'll bite.
Go ahead.
So we always say, you know, increasing food prices are sort of the gut reaction is that's got to be a bad thing, because we're used to going to the supermarket and, you know, if prices for milk go up, we're upset and we can buy less of it. But that's the way we interact with the food system in the Bay Area. You know, if you are a farmer, higher prices actually lead to higher revenues for you. So this paradigm that high food prices are bad for everybody is one we should, you know, carefully re-examine. The other way that, you know, food prices are strange is maybe one way of saying it is there are few examples of any economic systems that have more distortions than the agricultural sector through subsidies in all kinds of different crops and ways that make many, many foods that we know are bad for us artificially inexpensive. So I think thinking about how we price food going forward is also another big area of research.
Can I bite on that a little bit?
Oh, please, bite.
Actually, if you look at predictions of climate change on food and food security, we've talked a lot about the potential impact on yields or production. The reason that those impacts are actually really important for the majority of the world's population is because of their effect on prices. Food prices is very much a big issue for the world's poor. Again, half of the world's 800 million who live on less than $1.90 a day are farmers. They don't produce all the food that they eat. They still have to buy food. And whether you're the half that's producing and buying or you're the half that's in an urban area and just buying food, the cost of food is a much bigger burden on the world's poor than it is on us. So I can't tell you the price of a gallon of milk because I'm going to buy about, I have the privilege of having enough income to buy the milk regardless of the price. But for the world's poor, that is not a choice they have. They spend up to 50% of their income on food for the very poorest. So the impact of climate change on food prices is actually probably the biggest driver of the link to food security. Some climate models predict that, say, the price of cereals, maize, wheat, and rice, or corn, wheat, and rice, could go up as much as 25%. And that has a huge impact on the world's poor. And we know that in recent history. In 2008 and 2009, a number of global food commodities spiked in price very dramatically. And that kicked, I think was an estimated another 100 million people into poverty in the space of 2 years, just based on food prices. What distorts that even more, what compounds the impact of rising food prices is the fact that while our food system is based on more global interconnectedness, probably the biggest distortions that governments have on food prices are subsidies at the consumer level restrictions that they place on trade. So rice prices spiked in 2009, not because there were any major declines in productivity in major regions of the world, but because India closed its borders to exports of rice, and that greatly impacted a number of Asian countries who were having a hard time then buying rice because Asia was a global exporter. So those distortions are really important, but I don't want anyone to leave here to think that production and climate change is the big driver. It's really food prices that affects food security.
All right, we're almost done. I want to get one rapid-fire question in here. We might make it on the radio, so sometimes people listen and they try and figure out, this was interesting, I want my kids to be like those folks and work on that. If you had to send your kids to college and you think this is an interesting topic of inquiry, what should they study? David, you work at a university.
I do. It's
say economics, and I'll let you off.
I was gonna say mathematics, which right. Maybe is good enough. I think the real critical thing in a lot of this stuff is getting the numbers right, yeah. And that's also what I studied, so I'm biased.
Any other advice?
I think you can study anything. There's a huge political science dimension of food security. There's an economic dimension. There's a crop breeding or animal husbandry dimension. So I think food is one of these issues that spans the full range of the social and biological sciences. So I think you can come to it very productively from almost any angle.
I would say the intersections. We've alluded to it. I think the intersections among food, energy, water, climate, and thinking about them as interrelated systems would be the thing.
Take the silos away and let's start talking to each other. So on behalf of the World Affairs Council, I would like to thank Josette Lewis, David Lobel, and David Wasko for their enlightening remarks. And thank you, the audience, for your participation and great questions. So thank you, and thanks again to our speakers.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Featured in this episode were Josette Lewis of the World Food Center at UC Davis, David Lobel at Stanford Center on Food Security and Environment, and David Wasko of World Resources Institute. They were in conversation with UC Berkeley Professor Max Offheimer. The World Affairs Council is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org to share this episode, register for upcoming events, or to join the World Affairs Council. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producers Circle. Our recording engineer is Robert Zimmerman. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.